I'm back in the Aperto with Francesco Bonami, who was one of the curators of this part of the Biennale. You're someone who primarily lives in New York, but you're Italian. And how do you feel this has affected your selection for the Aperto? I mean, you have obviously got quite a close awareness of what's going on in New York. And this has somehow come out in the artists you've chosen, I think.
Yeah, I mostly chose artists that were living in New York and I met in New York. Besides Schumacher, that is in Cologne, and besides this, that I forgot to say, Maurizio Cattelan, that is in Italian, that actually I decided to include it after his a short visit of his in New York, and I talked with him extensively. And this time he took a space that the Biennale gave to him, and he sold the space to an advertising agency, and the advertising agency is using it in a really professional way. Yesterday, for example, people, advertising agent, came here to see if the light was proper for the thing, and it's a very straightforward operation. He sold the piece, and they give you actually money for him, and this new perfume is presented here with a very, very little amount of money. They have a very good spot, while there is, for example, the sponsor of the manifest of the Aperto, whose watch is much less and much less visible. So I think it's interesting that
there is something that seems to me to characterize some of the artists that you've brought together, which is a desire for some kind of interaction, or either the pieces can be touched and moved and affected that way, or they're about like the newspaper. We have lots of newspaper stands here where you can get this kind of special headline newspaper from Reinhold Schumacher. Even Charles Ray's piece, which is, although it's a relatively small object, it's incredibly heavy, so you're always aware that to get it in the space would have been difficult. How do you think this works in line with the theme of the exhibition, this kind of emergency? Were you responding to this whole theme somehow?
Well, I think I don't know if you can respond to a title of a show that is, means a lot and it means also nothing. We always are in a kind of emergency situation in terms of art that people produce, and I believe that to respond to a title like that, the better thing is to address a certain quality in the work of the artist, and the interaction it was not meant in my project, but I'm very happy that it developed in this way, because the title of this section is The Mere Interchange, and I really thought about pieces that could really create an exchange of vision between the viewer and the artist without mixing role. I mean, the viewer is the viewer and the artist is the artist with his piece, but in this case the viewer can, you know, touch it and you know, experience it in a more wider way, I hope, and that I hope that I succeed in that. I don't know. It's always very difficult to fit with the title of an exhibition like Realism Emergency. I mean, we always are real in any respect, so I hope that this piece are both real and helpful.
I'm talking to Sean Landers in his space at the Aperto, and we've got a video here running, and on the floor three figures, and around two walls, along the length of one wall, there's this yellow, is it legal?
Legal pad.
Legal pad. Sheets of paper glued on the wall, or kind of stuck on the wall, with a long text written on it. Could you tell me a little bit about the pieces that you've got here?
Starting with the text, it's a piece of 1,000 pages titled 1,000 Pages or I'll Blow Your Mother's Brains Out. It's so, because it's forced writing, and it's based on that when I was a kid that I used to do things like that I didn't want to do, like mow the lawn or shovel the snow off the sidewalk, by imagining a thug with a gun to my mother's head threatening to blow her brains out, and then my love for my mother would make the task more tolerable. So it's really quite weird and quite Catholic way of thinking. And so I'm writing this piece trying to, like, because I haven't been a Catholic since I was 17, really, so just trying to, like, kick the rest of it out of my body. And all these pieces here kind of deal with the same things. And here I write about my first sexual experience with a girl from my neighborhood named Melanie, and seeing her vagina for the first time was like seeing Christ's dead body on the cross, and things like this. Touching it was like an equally guilty feeling. And these sculptures are leprechauns coming out of I don't know what. I think I just need to make things that really aren't that heavy.
The three, what are they made of? Are they,
they're terracotta with green glaze.
Right, and they're
Danny
seeming.
Boy of Dingle.
Sorry?
Danny Boy of Dingle, and he's bending over and farting while standing on two copulating turtles. So it means absolutely nothing. And this one is after Rodin's John the Baptist, because it's probably one of the worst sculptures ever, but we have to look at it all the time. And the other one is nothing but just, you know, the boxer, John L. Sullivan, but it's like the smart guy, his manager in the stomach, and the dumb guy up top.
are these quite new pieces, these kind of leprechaun things?
I actually modeled them like 6 or 7 months ago, but the process of casting them and firing them and ceramically just takes forever.
Could we look at the video briefly? Could you tell me a bit about this? It seems to be you.
Yeah. It's me doing St. Sebastian there, I believe, or something like it. I don't know. I don't know what I can really say. It's kind of self-evident. I'm just posing like Italian High Renaissance and Baroque sculptures and watching myself in a video monitor as I do it. So for me, it just became, I guess, quite masturbatory and entertaining on that level. And it's just a way to, I think, to, you know, just very simply spell out the Catholic / sex issue, I guess, in sculpture too. So it kind of ties the writing and the sculpture together in a very fast way. And obviously, it's like I wanted people to stop in my booth. And the surprising thing is it seems to attract more heterosexual, like working class men who are like the workers here. And I was hoping it would attract more women, quite frankly. It backfired. And lots of men are hitting on me every night and making me terribly uncomfortable.
I heard that you were quite nervous about showing this piece. Is that right?
Or I was in the beginning, but I'm not now. Admittedly, though, standing in front of it here with you now makes me slightly uncomfortable. But
I'm here in the Aperte with Rikrit Tiravinit. And we're standing by his piece. Does it have a title, this piece?
Well, it's untitled. It does have a subtitle of 1271, which, if I could say, was the year that Marco Polo left Venice for the East.
Right, so what we've got here is this kind of tin or aluminium
canoe,
and standing in the canoe are two gas burners, and on top of each burner is a large pot full of water, which is being heated by the burners. Just around about the piece, there are a number of tables and chairs. Also, a couple of artists have installed video works around, so that you can basically sit around at the tables and watch some of the videos and take noodles from a large stack of noodles that were here that have now all been eaten, and sit around and eat them. Tell me a bit about the work you've been doing in general and how this relates to what you've been working on recently.
Well, I'm have a few layers of things that I'm interested in within the work itself. Some are more subtle than others, and I usually work with the context that I'm in, working within, like, in terms of the space or the show. I've been using food as, a base or a frame for social exchange. My interest is main kind of more particular with the exchange that goes on within the context of like having a meal or, you know, drinking coffee and watching videos. I like as much as possible when the piece works best when people interact with each other, you know, in context of having to deal with the work. There are certain imageries that I draw out from my own background, being from Thailand. I use a lot of, I cook food which is kind of based on my own cultural background. Often most of the work kind of addresses that kind of cultural crossing and retrieval, which I'm attempting to do also for myself.
Tell me what happens. I mean, the piece of work inevitably changes during the course of an exhibition. Could you tell me about what's happening here?
I mean, within this situation right here.
Yeah, so we started with a large stack of noodles.
We started up with about 1,000, 1,500 cups of noodles, which were shipped in from New York. The noodles in particular, they're made by a Japanese-American company. It is a brand name known as Cup of Noodles, which is exactly what they are. They come in various different flavors. And they're basically particularly oriental kind of flavored. They do have label across them that says oriental noodle soup, which I think is a bit more particular than a lot of other pots of noodles. I'm playing with imagery that comes both from my background being brought up in Bangkok, which also is known as Venice of the East, having kind of a city within kind of canals. And so there's the centerpiece, which is the canoe, and the pots, which are cooking. And this is kind of based on boats that come down the canals in Bangkok, which sells noodle, and you can sit by the water and such. And within that, I'm playing around the mythology of Marco Polo going east and having brought back the idea of pasta and noodle, which is, I suppose, you know, kind of originated in the east. The work is really shaped and formed by the audience or whoever is in the space and becomes involved with it. And I think within that situation, for me, it all, you know, I enjoy being in group shows because it kind of focuses on a, you know, the idea of that relationship to viewing artwork or, you know, so there's, for me, it's always, I mean, workable.
I'm speaking to Damien Hirst about his piece in the Aperto. What's the title of the work? I can't remember.
Child divided.
Right. So there's two larger tanks which are sort of separated. There's a walkway. There's a kind of gap between them. You can walk through the middle. And each tank has got half a cow sort of suspended somehow, sort of bolted to a piece of perspex. And they're in formaldehyde. And then a bit further away to one side, there are two smaller tanks with a calf bolted in place. So what happens is when you walk around the outside, you see the furry exterior bit. And then as you walk through the central bit, you see the internal workings. Was this made specifically for this show in mind?
Yeah. I kind of thought about it before, but it's made for Aperto. My Renaissance piece.
It's not. It's doesn't have quite the same feeling as I expected it. I expected it to be much more disgusting or something. It's actually quite. People seem interested in it as just a thing. They don't recoil and go ugh or anything?
I think everybody's interested in seeing inside things. I think it's quite unavoidable. You can't help it. And it's removed far enough for you to not have to get your hands dirty or anything. So, and it's held together. I mean, it's not... You can always go around the other side if you get repulsed by the inside.
How did you cut it in half? How was it cut?
Chainsaw.
I think that before the piece was installed, there was a lot of speculation about it being somehow a kind of spectacle. There was some idea that the piece might be quite spectacular in a way that would overshadow things, but I don't think it's happened quite that way. It's definitely been used. It sort of fits in much better. I thought it was going to be really overwhelming somehow.
I don't know. I don't really, didn't really thought about that. I mean, the cow's kind of larger than life, so I expected it to feel larger than life, but not in a overwhelming way. I mean, I think it's, I don't know, I mean, it's the first time I've seen it. I think it's one of those things that when you put them together, there's something more there than you kind of imagined. I mean, it's a sculpture that will have a life after this, so it can, you know, it can be shown anywhere. I quite like to see how that shows, how that develops.
Quite a lot of the work in the show seems to centre around, like, some problematized area about the whole idea of being an artist at all. Like, there's someone like Sean Landers writing these long texts about how uncomfortable he feels about things, and they're sort of confessional aspects to a lot of the work, and sort of meandering around and sort of messing about and this kind of thing. I mean, how do you think you fit into all of that in terms of what you're doing?
I don't know, really. I mean, I think I kind of... I think maybe I'm pretty traditional, really, at the end of the day. I've been doing drawings recently. And kind of just, you know, can't really be bothered. I think, I mean, the more you do, it all fits together in some kind of a thing which becomes you, and you can't escape that. I think everybody's pushing the boundaries, but at the end of the day, it's always art, isn't it? Or trying to. What do you do after Duchamp's put a toilet on the wall or on a plinth?
I'm here with Henry Bond, and he's made a video titled On the Buses, which is part of Vaporetto project, organized by Benjamin Weil. The video is placed in a side room just off the main aperto, and a monitor's positioned on a garden bench, and there's another one just at an angle to that where you can sit and watch the video. Could you tell me where you shot it and a little bit about the video?
The project that Benjamin Weil selected me for, somehow a series of public works which would be undertaken somehow in a relationship to the Vaporetti, which is the public transport water buses in Venice. I came here 2 weeks ago to make the film, which was what I proposed to Benjamin was to shoot a short video on the water buses, which would be some kind of what was really in my mind was the fact that I imagined that a lot of tourists use the buses, which is in fact the case, and there's some kind of relationship between the tourists using the buses or visitors to Venice using the buses and people who are just living and working in Venice who are also using the buses. I think that was a starting point for his project in general. But what interested me particularly was the fact that many people are using camcorders on the buses all the time. And that allowed me a situation where I could film with a certain amount of intimacy that would not be available to me in other situations. So I was attempting to use that, which is something that is, in a sense, being handed to me, and use that to my advantage. I think that What I was really looking at before making the film was certain received ideas I had about Venice, and they were very much related to, in a sense, the dramatic or horror genre of filmmaking. I looked at Italo Calvino, I looked at Daphne du Maurier, Nicholas Roeg, Don't Look Now, and maybe to a lesser extent, Death in Venice. Venice has often been used as a signifier for some kind of world turned upside down, literally the world turned upside down. And that, I suppose, is were the received ideas that I had about Venice as well. The fact that, as in many of the many other works that I looked at, that I was looking at, that very mundane and simple situations in Venice can quickly become something would is much less readily recognizable. And so what I was really doing was using this kind of camcorder intimacy to take mundane and simple situations, daily life, and use that in the context of my received ideas about Venice.
Video by Henry Bond. Angela Bullock, could you start by describing your work in the Aperto?
I can't remember my
Well,
face.
What I've done is I've put two pieces on show, but you I've made some fairly controlled housing for those pieces so that they're seen in a particular way. One of the pieces is a video, which I've made, and the other piece is a light
the
piece,
in the white fur.
And
She's
one
the
is reflected
one
in the other, if you like. That's how they've been
she
positioned.
You
in fact, we
left.
Can hear the soundtrack of the video as we speak. Could you talk a little bit about the underlying concerns of this work?
I remember perfectly
well.
I was trying to
take some kind of utopian model, which is this film, which I'd chosen for a lot of different reasons. It's a Russian film made in early 70s, and I felt really that was something that was really lost, and it was made for all the utopianistic kind of modern reasons, but it was a very sad film, a kind of fractured modern film, and it was really for those reasons I chose to use parts of that film, and I did various things to it, and I changed it really really a lot.
Can you talk a little bit about the imagery of the film and how you've changed it, because I believe you've kind of condensed a longer film, you've edited it and put it together.
Oh yes, in terms of time, it's from something like a 4-hour film into a 30-minute film. So what I've got is I've basically controlled the editing according to certain things happening, like every edit's done on somebody waking up or dying, and that somehow reflects also in the light piece, which is opposite that. The light pieces sort of do that too.
But with the film, you've actually re-recorded the dialogue, which, as I say, we're hearing snatches of it as we speak. I mean, what is the relationship between the original film and the re-recorded dialogue that includes your voice and other people's voices?
It's really just about the way that the film looks, and you hear the voice at a different kind of rate to that. I mean, it's the sync, the lip-syncing of it doesn't work in an entirely correct way, so you would have something which is essentially a Russian film with very English spoken language, but it looks like a bad translation, basically. It looks more like a Brazilian film or something.
Is it a work you made specifically for the Aperto?
Yeah.
I'll see to it.
Yes.
And you were, in fact, I mean, talking now more generally about the Biennale, where the notion of national selections has been somewhat challenged. I mean, you've been selected by Nicolas Bourriaud, the French curator. I mean, are there any issues there that you want to elaborate on?
No, not really. Just that I feel that he's chosen a variety of different artists from different kinds of countries and things, but that wasn't his concern. He wasn't trying to make a nationalistic selection. He was trying to, it seems to me that he chose artists that had in some way examined the use of different systems within their work, and he definitely took a position against the kind of curatorial aspects of flower arranging your artists so that they look, you know, like one cohesive aesthetic choice, so somehow you see them very easily fitting together. He didn't do that, so unlike other Nothing. Curators.
So there were common denominators between the artists that he'd selected. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
All right.
Well, I really think that he, none of the artists' work looks anything like each other. Neither did they choose any. They have very different ways of handling the space. They also had really not much to do with each other, and so it was a very odd looking section of the aperto. But I mean, to its credit, I think it was really linked in conceptual terms. It was really about work examining a particular specific system or other.
Could it be epilepsy?
I'm now about to speak to Julia Scher in the aperto section. Julia, could you start by physically describing the piece you have here, which just very generally seems to me to be an area of sand covering the end here in the corderia, and a metal tower with security camera and monitor. But perhaps you can talk more about the specific concerns of this work.
Well, I've used architectural elements that are pulled from many different venues of surveillance or Überwachung styles. And this is an archetypal broken penis flagpole with a supporting but ineffectual scaffolding behind it. Everything that I could get made of aluminum is made of aluminum, and it's kind of chunked, bolted together in ways that are not normal in surveillance practices. That is, this is very unsecure, and it's a very, maybe it's a tiny but somewhat imposing pole, bedecked, bejeweled with bits of surveillance equipment. But this is not an ordinary installation per se, in that it is very unsafe, could be stolen quite easily, and gives a false sense of security. But it does contain the elements of extra super high tech, that is, it's a very complicated pan-tilt drive with color and black and white computer control camera, surveillance wands holding switchers, character generators, power supplies, and television monitor. And behind, you'll see a broken flagpole with the ball kind of bagging down, hanging out over the edge of a glass-bedecked wall. And there's a window behind.
As we speak, in fact, we're appearing on the monitor recorded by the camera. It's a very familiar image now, isn't it? This idea of surveillance and security and everybody watching everybody. I mean, can you talk more about that aspect of it, which seems to be an obsession that the modern world has?
Well, actually, I'm a voyeur, pretty much. But this work embraces both true physical voyeurism, and that one can be watched and be watching simultaneously. This particular piece embraces the discourse of surveillance, that is, there's the threat of high-tech security, when in fact there is very, very little of it. The moment you see a camera, you may think and register that there is security or someone watching you, when in fact there may not be at all. So I use that capacity for understanding, in the broader cultural sense, the use of a surveillance strategy, which is used to create behaviors, not prevent them, and use that here as art. Again, I do this as my real work in the real world as well as an artist. That is, I have a company, Safe and Secure, in which I install surveillance equipment, television monitors, cameras, burglar alarms, gratings, motion detectors, control stations, that is, a home being routed to a central station monitoring locale as my work. So I stride both worlds. This is, I have been accused of being complicit with a regime that is certainly out to repress and control individuals and their own representation. But in fact, that's exactly the area I want to be, that gray area between collusion and providing a service for people, as well as showing the rupture, the breaks in these kinds of power systems, which tend to enhance security in some respects, but of course take away individual liberties on the other hand.
On a more general note, I mean, do you have anything to say about the context of Venice Biennale and Aperto in particular and your work within it?
Some of the curatorial attempts have been gestures in a direction of what in the United States has been called for many years multiculturalism. We have this Hineingemisch, an appropriation of all fields, which I think is great. Yet, on the other hand, here we still have one token African-American artist, and there's a cluster of Latina and Latino artists as well. So I think, on the one hand, there is a good sense of gesturing and reaching out. And this I look forward to seeing more of, not just gesture. But this is a good place to point from.
I'm talking to Gianni Romano, who's a curator, Italian curator, who's here looking at the whole Biennale. What's your general impression, if you have one, that is, about the success of this year's Aperto?
I do have a general impression, is that the overall impression is that this Aperto is very good, especially compared to the previous ones. And though there is some darkest area, like I think one of the mistakes is that there are too many curators, so the quality is not always that good. But technically speaking, I think when you get into Aperto, you get a very good impression, which is lasting through half of the space. And then you find something which is not, you know, you can make a show with 116 artists, whatever, you know, you need a strict selection. And a strict selection also in curators. You can't put seven people together, you know, get along, of course, there are different ideas. And in this sense, I think the best spaces are those of like Bonami and Bob Nikas, which probably is also the most experienced people in Aperto. I think also one of the mistakes was above. I mean, the head curators, which is not really high quality, no experience at all. So it's quite ridiculous that people like that is managing, you know, in this. As assistant, they have people that has more experience than they have. But this is something politically I don't want to, you know, get involved in. I'm just reasoning technically as a curator myself. So you were saying about the artists in there. I've been working with like 20 artists which are in Aperto, and I got to say that they are the ones I prefer. For me, there's no big surprise. Just confirmation of the work they've been doing through these years. And I think that everything worked perfectly. Also, I've seen some artists that I've been following and did not really work with, like Filippo Rino, which made a great work, and some other arts. I think it's very good. The overall impression is very good.
Yeah. As an Italian, how important is the Biennale for the whole art scene in Italy, and especially for the younger artists and curators like yourself? Is this something that is very important for you as an event?
For an artist, for an Italian artist, beside, of course, the exciting thing of being in such a big event, the biggest thing is the market. When you get to Aperto, your work sells, you know, much easier. But anyway, it's very important because you get a lot of you get covered. Media and stuff and people, audience, big audience. So,
do you think it's a good selection of contemporary Italian work in the Aperto? Are they the good artists who are working now?
It's totally crazy. This selection of Italian artists doesn't respect the actual situation in Italy. So it is the result of too many compromises. And at the beginning, I was really afraid that some of the good artists that, luckily enough, now they are here, wouldn't be there, just because of political situation, you know. But at the end, I got to say that also artists that I personally don't like made a good, work.
Okay, I'm with Julie Roberts, and you're sharing a space in a way with Vong Farfanet. And there are three paintings here. Are they new works for the aperto?
Uh-huh. Yeah, they're made for the show.
And what are the titles of the works here?
There's the theatre robe greens, which is the green theatre robe that, you know, men or women would wear to go into theatre for the operation.
What, the patients or the
patients, yeah. There's the operating table with attachments for gynecological and urological treatment. And then there's the gynecological couch, which is draped with a white sheet and hovering within a kind of very dark blue background colour field.
Right, so in many ways, the aperto as a whole has got a lot of diverse work in it, and it's quite, you can hear the noise around us, it's quite an active place, and there's videos playing, there are things making noises, moving around, there are videos on. How do you feel about the context within which your work's being seen here?
Well, I think all group shows that's the give and take of the situation. That they're curated by this particular, you know, with 100 artists, are curated by, 13 different curators from all over the world. It's bound to, I knew that it would be chaotic in one sense or another. In another way, there's some kind of chaos in the work anyway, so it doesn't matter. They're not quiet little paintings that need to be, you know, sectioned off in a little room on their own. I quite like them being amongst the chaos. At the same time, they can be on their own if they have to be, you know.
It's funny because in sort of by accident somehow, your work literally works with the theme of the exhibition, this kind of emergency. It's quite odd. But in a formal sense, they are paintings, and they are something that are quite elegant and contained within themselves. There's no... you're always dealing with something that's sort of been captured. How much of a sense is there in the work about sort of reclaiming these kind of things which end up looking like torture instruments somehow? It's like you have, by painting them, are you gaining control over them somehow?
In a way, I mean, then that's dealing with the subject, which is obviously what the work's about. I mean, in a sense that if you see them in the real, they are quite frightening and overpowering and quite patronizing as well. Whenever we all fall ill and go to hospital, it's terrifying, and we just want to get better and get out of there again. So on the one hand, they help you, on the other hand, they terrify you at the same time. When I paint them, I reduce the size of them, so then, you know, that they can be frightening sometimes, but they're not. They're endearing also. They draw you towards them. They're not so, I don't know, frightening as they could be, and for me, by painting them, I get less and less frightened of them because I get more and more used to them. And maybe that's why people like them, because it plays on all those aspects of the psyche.
Sadie Benning's video piece titled It Wasn't Love.
Plan, and I was to follow.
I'm with Benjamin Val, who put together part of the aperto that was conceived not to take place in the main exhibition area, but on the Vaporetti. How was the project conceived in the first place? What were you really thinking about?
I was thinking of the idea of a public who's constantly in transit, so it's changing all the time. I was thinking of a public space. I was thinking of something that sort of confronts art to reality in a much more compelling manner.
And then I asked all these six artists to do a project. Henry Bond's response was to return the proposal, and instead of like doing something on the boat, he did something about the boat. That's why he's inside with this videotape. And Lothar was planning to have street singers sing about the boats. But one thing that we found out is that there is some very strong technical requirements that makes some projects impossible to realize, which is something that we have to discover along the way. I think that working in a public space is very different from working in an art space where you can pretty much do whatever you want.
The thing to point out about these river buses is that they're certainly not luxurious. They're very tough, and they're metal boats with very hard seats, and they're packed full of people using them for day-to-day transport. It's got nothing to do with the mythology of Venice with gondolas and elegant speedboats. It's a very utilitarian thing that people use all the time. Could you give me an idea about what all of the artists that you got involved with this project actually did in the end?
I think that it's good that you underline this, because that's another thing that I wanted to underline, is that these boats are taken as like part of this exoticism, and that in fact they are completely like normal buses in any other city. It's just that because it's Venice, people like sort of look at them like, oh, isn't it so wonderful, kind of attitude. And the other thing is that the response that artists had towards these boats was really to reinstate that these boats are actually part of the reality of a certain number of people that we're not really confronted with, because basically Venice is tourist land. It's like, you know, somebody called it a cultural Disneyland the other day, and I think it's pretty much a good description of the situation.
One of the things that strikes me about the Aperto as a whole is that while artists have moved on and tried to investigate other systems and ways to interact with society through their art, this still essentially remains an exhibition within a building, and it doesn't seem to have broken out of that. Your project, however, is something that's tried to get away from and break things a bit more. Was this complicated to organize or problematic to put together?
I think that what is really complicated is that once you are out of this protected environment of art, you get confronted to reality. And this reality is that, you know, if you think about boats, for instance, there are rules that are like, you know, linked to the fact that you cannot offend people, that you cannot do something that's threatening them, that, you know, attains to their security. You cannot drop something on the boat that invades the space. You cannot put something that covers up the advertising space without paying for it. There's a lot of things that you're not allowed to do. I mean, you know, the constraints are much stronger, but they are very important, because then they become really part of the work and the dynamic.
This morning when I was sitting outside somewhere, one of the boats went past, packed with people. I mean, really overloaded and swaying around. Written on the side of the boat in very beautiful, elegant writing was "Les Boat People." I wonder if you could tell me about this piece of work.
That's a project that was made by Franz Staffenberg and Christopher Roth, who are two German artists working together. The idea of like putting boat people is sort of like really disturbing people, sort of like putting the paparazzi, as you said, are most of the time full, particularly during the tourist season. So if you write "Les Boat People," it's like, you know, all of a sudden there's this twist situation. People never think that being a boat people could ever happen to themselves. It's a little bit like homeless, but homeless is like more inside our cities in the Western world, so it's less exotic. But it's like there is some kind of an exoticism about Les Boat People. So it's a really multi-leveled installation, because it could be like we're in Venice, so being boat people is no problem. We're in vacations. I mean, I don't know. For me, it's like a really complex level of... There's so many levels of reading. The graphic is... the color is like an advertising color. It's like this bright orange or this bright blue, so you can see it from really far. And then this wedding invitation type of, you know, stupid writing is also sort of like making it precious. I mean, it's also saying "Les boat people" as if it was the chicest thing to be boat people. So, I mean, it's critical, but it's at the same time an incredible amount of humor.
Who are these people?
Who are these people?
Yeah.
Oh, they're from a squatted house here in Venice. And this squatted house called Centro Sociale Morion. And they're about 16, 17 years old. And that's a second open gig, I mean, in public. And I think they're quite boring.
It seems quite popular, though. Lots of people are going now.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. It's really filling up.
Oh, that's cool. I like it a lot.
So,
maybe this is one of the stupidest interviews you ever got this day?
It's probably the best, actually. I got some good taping of the music.
Yeah.
Yeah, I got it already. So is this part of your project for Venice?
This is my project in a way. Yeah, right now. I mean, my project splits in two parts. It's I made posters of the lyrics of this band, and I put them everywhere in the Vaporetto stops, down from the station to here, to this place. So that's the whole concert. They play 15 songs. The whole concert is in inside of the Vaporetto stops. You can read it. I mean, anyway. So, and yeah, kind of working with these people is my project, right?
How did you find them?
Just by chance. I had a totally different kind of project in mind, and then it came that everything broke down because here are no street singers. First, I wanted to work with three street singers, should sing on the Vaporetto, another brick in the wall, but all of them should get different lyrics. And it failed totally because it's not allowed anymore. It's strictly forbidden to sing in the streets in Venice. So it's really like...
In case the buildings fall down or something?
No, it's like... Anyway, if you sing this song, another brick in the wall, the buildings definitely will fall down. But it's really, you go for one day in jail. So finally I found one street singer, and he was arrested in front of me when I started to try to convince him for joining my project. So then I went to Mestre and talked to a lot of people, and finally I found these people, and I found this squatted house, and so I started to discuss how it should go on. Yeah, and they were quite enthusiastic about the whole idea, because this squatted house is really kind of, it's got really bad reputation here inside of the city, and they want to stop it. And so I thought it's quite a good idea that they can, you know, that this band, you know, stands for this squatted house and the whole people, and they have this chance to do something really directly in the city and the part of the city, which, because the government?
Yeah.
The government gave them this one house, which is really down outside of the city. Nobody pays attention to it. Yeah? But anyway, they want to close it down. So I thought it might be a good idea to bring this back down here, really close to also to the Biennale, to show people, I mean, this kind of, you know, this kind of resistance. We'll be right back.